20. A fool's errand. Somewhere in the notes, Estreben wrote, during our trek across the Gobrin ice, he wonders why his companion is ashamed to cry. I could have told him even then that it was not shame so much as fear. Now I went on through the Synoth Valley, through the evening of his death, into the cold country that lies beyond fear. I found you can weep all you like, but there's no good in it. I was taken back to Sassenoth and imprisoned because I had been in the company of an outlaw, and probably because they did not know what else to do with me. From the start, even before official orders came from Erhenrang, they treated me well. My Karhidish jail was a furnished room in the Tower of the Lords Elect in Sassenoth. I had a fireplace, a radio, and 5 large meals daily. It was not comfortable. The bed was hard, the covers thin, the floor bare, the air cold, like any room in Karhide. But they sent in a physician, in whose hands and voice was a more enduring, a more profitable comfort than any I ever found in Orgorain. After he came, I think the door was left unlocked. I recall it standing open, and myself wishing it was shut because of the chill draft of air from the hall. But I had not the strength, the courage, to get off my bed and shut my prison door. The physician, a grave, maternal young fellow, told me with an air of peaceable certainty,
"You have been underfed and overtaxed for 5 or 6 months. You have spent yourself. There is nothing more to spend. Lie down, rest. Lie down like the rivers frozen in the valleys in winter. Lie still. Wait."
But when I slept, I was always in the truck, huddling together with the others, all of us stinking, shivering, naked, squeezed together for warmth, all but one. One lay by himself against the barred door, the cold one, with a mouth full of clotted blood. He was the traitor. He had gone on by himself, deserting us, deserting me. I would wake up full of rage, a feeble, shaky rage that turned into feeble tears. I must have been rather ill, for I remember some of the effects of high fever, and the physician stayed with me one night, or perhaps more. I can't recall those nights, but do remember saying to him, and hearing the querulous, keening note in my own voice,
"He could have stopped. He saw the guards. He ran straight into the guns."
The young physician said nothing for a while.
"You're not saying that he killed himself?" "Perhaps." "That's a bitter thing to say of a friend, and I will not believe it of Harthrem Ir Istraven."
I had not had in mind when I spoke the contemptibility of suicide to these people. It is not to them, as to us, an option. It is the abdication from option, the act of betrayal itself. To a Karhida reading our canons, the crime of Judas lies not in his betrayal of Christ, but in the act that, sealing despair, denies the chance of forgiveness, change, life, his suicide.
"Then you don't call him Estreven the traitor?"
"Not ever did. There are many who never heeded the accusations against him, Mr. A.I.
But I was unable to see any solace in that, and only cried out in the same torment,
"Then why did they shoot him? Why is he dead?"
To this, he made no answer, there being none. I was never formally interrogated. They asked how I had got out of the Pulafan farm and into Karhide, and they asked the destination and intent of the code message I had sent on their radio. I told them. That information went straight to Erhenrang, to the king. The matter of the ship was apparently held secret, but the news of my escape from an Orgotha prison, my journey over the ice in winter, my presence in Sassenoth was freely reported and discussed. Estreven's part in this was not mentioned on the radio, nor was his death. Yet it was known. Secrecy in Karhide is to an extraordinary extent a matter of discretion, of an agreed, understood silence, an omission of questions, yet not an omission of answers. The bulletin spoke only of the envoy, Mr. AI, but everybody knew it was Harthrem Ir Estraven who had stolen me from the hands of the Orgota and come with me over the ice to Karhai to give the staring lie to the commensal's tale of my sudden death from Horm fever in Mishnori last autumn. Estraven had predicted the effects of my return fairly accurately. He had erred mainly in underestimating them. Because of the alien who lay ill, not acting, not caring, in a room in Sassinoth, two governments fell within 10 days. To say that an Orgota government fell means, of course, that only one group of commensals replaced another group of commensals in the controlling offices of the 33. Some shadows got shorter and some longer, as they say in Karhide. The Saaf faction that had sent me off to Pulafen hung on, despite the not unprecedented embarrassment of being caught lying, until Argaven's public announcement of the imminent arrival of the starship in Karhide. That day, Obsli's party, the open trade faction, took over the presiding offices of the 33. So I was of some service to them after all. In Karhide, the fall of a government is most likely to mean the disgrace and replacement of a prime minister along with a reshuffling of the Kaioremi, although assassinations, abdications, and insurrection are all frequent alternatives. Tiber made no effort to hang on. My current value in the game of international Shif Grethor, plus my vindication, by implication, of Estraven, gave me, as it were, a prestige weight so clearly surpassing his that he resigned, as I later learned, even before the Erhenran government knew that I had radioed to my ship. He acted on the tip-off from Thesiger, waited only till he got word of Estraven's death, and then resigned. He had his defeat and his revenge for it, all in one. Once Argaven was fully informed, he sent me a summons, a request to come at once to Erhenran, and along with it a liberal allowance for expenses. The city of Sassinoth, with equal liberality, sent their young physician along with me, for I was not in very good shape yet. We made the trip in power sledges. I remember only parts of it. It was smooth and unhurried, with long halts waiting for packers to clear the road, and long nights spent at inns. It could only have taken 2 or 3 days, but it seemed a long trip, and I can't recall much of it, till the moment when we came through the northern gates of Erhenran into the deep streets full of snow and shadow. I felt then that my heart hardened somewhat, and my mind cleared. I had been all in pieces, disintegrated. Now, though tired from the easy journey, I found some strength left whole in me. Strength of habit, most likely, for here at last was a place I knew, a city I had lived in, worked in for over a year. I knew the streets, the towers, the somber courts, and the ways and facades of the palace. I knew my job here. Therefore, for the first time, it came plainly to me that, my friend being dead, I must accomplish the thing he died for. I must set the keystone in the arch. At the palace gates, the order was for me to proceed to one of the guest houses within the palace walls. It was the Round Tower dwelling, which signalled a high degree of Shif Grethor in the court, not so much the king's favour as his recognition of a status already high. Ambassadors from friendly powers were usually lodged there. It was a good sign. To get it, however, we had to pass by the Corner Red dwelling. And I looked in the narrow arched gateway, at the bare tree over the pool, grey with ice, and the house that still stood empty. At the door of the Round Tower, I was met by a person in white hieb and crimson shirt, with a silver chain over his shoulders, Fax, the foreteller of the Othahord fastness. At sight of his kind and handsome face, the first known face that I had seen for many days, a rush of relief softened my mood of strained resolution. When Fax took my hands in the rare Karhidish greeting and welcomed me as his friend, I could make some response to his warmth. He had been sent to the Kaioremi from his district, South Rur, early in the autumn. Election of council members from the indwellers of Handara fastness is not uncommon. It is, however, not common for a weaver to accept office, and I believe Fax would have refused if he had not been much concerned by Tiber's government and the direction in which it was leading the country. So, he had taken off the weaver's gold chain and put on the councillor's silver one, and he had not spent long in making his mark, for he had been, since Thurn, a member of the Heskaoremi, or Inner Council, which serves as counterweight to the Prime Minister, and it was the King who had named him to that position. He was, perhaps, on his way up to the eminence from which Estreven less than a year ago had fallen. Political careers in Karhide are abrupt, precipitous. In the Round Tower, a cold, pompous little house, Fax and I talked at some length before I had to see anyone else or make any formal statement or appearance. He asked, with his clear gaze on me,
"There is a ship coming, then? Coming down to Earth? A larger ship than the one you came to Horden Island on 3 years ago, is that right?"
"Yes. That is, I sent a message that should prepare it to come."
"When will it come?"
When I realized that I did not even know what day of the month it was, I began to realize how badly off I had in fact been lately. I had to count back to the day before Estreven's death. When I found that the ship, if it had been at minimum distance, would already be in planetary orbit awaiting some word from me, I had another shock. "I must communicate with the ship. They'll want instructions. Where does the King want them to come down? It should be an uninhabited area, fairly large. I must get to a transmitter." Everything was arranged, expeditiously, with ease. The endless convolutions and frustrations of my previous dealings with the Erhenran government were melted away like ice pack in a flooding river. The wheel turned. Next day, I was to have an audience with the King. It had taken Estreven 6 months to arrange my first audience. It had taken the rest of his life to arrange this second one. I was too tired to be apprehensive this time, and there were many things on my mind that outweighed self-consciousness. I went down the long red hall under the dusty banners, and stood before the dais with its three great hearths, where three bright fires cracked and sparkled. The King sat by the central fireplace, hunched up on a carven stool by the table.
"Sit down, Mr. AI."
I sat down across the hearth from Argaven, and saw his face in the light of the flames. He looked unwell and old. He looked like a woman who has lost her baby, like a man who has lost his son.
"Well, Mr. AI, so your ship's going to land?"
"It will land in Athten Fen, as you requested, sir. They should bring it down this evening at the beginning of third hour."
"What if they miss the place? Will they burn everything up?"
"They'll follow a radio beam straight in. That's all been arranged. They won't miss."
"And how many of them are there? 11? Is that right?"
Yes. Not enough to be afraid of, my lord." Argraven's hands twitched in an unfinished gesture.
"I am no longer afraid of you, Mr. AI."
"I'm glad of that."
"You've served me well."
"But I am not your servant."
"I know it,"
he said indifferently. He stared at the fire, chewing the inside of his lip. "My Ansible transmitter is in the hands of the Sarf in Mishnori, presumably. However, when the ship comes down, it will have an Ansible aboard. I will have, thenceforth, if acceptable to you, the position of envoy, plenipotentiary of the Ecumen, and will be empowered to discuss and sign a treaty of alliance with Karhide. All this can be confirmed with Hain and the various stabilities by Ansible."
"Very well."
I said no more, for he was not giving me his whole attention. He moved a log in the fire with his boot toe, so that a few red sparks crackled up from it.
"Why the devil did he cheat me?"
he demanded in his high, strident voice, and for the first time looked straight at me. I said, sending back his stare.
Estreven!
He saw to it that you didn't cheat yourself. He got me out of sight when you began to favor a faction, unfriendly to me. He brought me back to you when my return would, in itself, persuade you to receive the mission of the Ecumen and the credit for it.
Why did he never say anything about this larger ship to me?
because he didn't know about it. I never spoke to anyone of it until I went to Orgorain.
And a fine lot you chose to blab to there, you two. He tried to get the Orgotha to receive your mission. He was working with their open traders all along. You'll tell me that was not betrayal?
It was not. He knew that whichever nation first made alliance with the Ecumen, the other would follow soon. As it will. As Sith and Perunta and the archipelago will also follow until you find unity. He loved his country very dearly, sir. But he did not serve it, or you. He served the master I serve.
The Ecumen?
Said Argaven, startled.
No.
Mankind. As I spoke, I did not know if what I said was true. True in part, an aspect of the truth. It would be no less true to say that Estraven's act had risen out of pure personal loyalty, a sense of responsibility and friendship towards one single human being, myself. Nor would that be the whole truth. The king made no reply. His somber, pouched, furrowed face was turned again to the fire.
Why did you call to this ship of yours before you notified me of your return to Karhide?
To force your hand, sir. A message to you would also have reached Lord Tiber, who might have handed me over to the Orgotha, or had me shot, as he had my friend shot. The king said nothing. My own survival doesn't matter all that much, but I have and had then a duty towards Gethen and the Ecumen, a task to fulfill. I signaled the ship first, to ensure myself of some chance of fulfilling it. That was Estraven's counsel. And it was right.
Well, it was not wrong. At any rate, they'll land here. We shall be the first. And they're all like you, eh? All perverts, always in Kemmer. A queer lot to vie for the honor of receiving. Tell Lord Gotchen, the Chamberlain, how they expect to be received. See to it that there's no offense or omission. They'll be lodged in the palace, wherever you think suitable. I wish to show them honor. You've done me a couple of good turns, Mr. A.I. Made liars of the commensals, and then fools.
And presently allies, my lord.
I know, he said shrilly. But Karhide first. Karhide first.
I nodded. After some silence, he said,
How was it, that pull across the ice?
Not easy.
Estraven would be a good man to pull with, on a crazy trek like that. He was tough as iron, and never lost his temper. I'm sorry he's dead.
I found no reply.
I'll receive your countrymen in audience tomorrow afternoon at second hour. Is there more need say now?
My lord, will you revoke the order of exile on Estraven? To clear his name?
Not yet, Mr. A.I., don't rush it. Anything more?
No more.
Go on then.
Even I betrayed him. I had said I would not bring the ship down till his banishment was ended, his name cleared. I could not throw away what he had died for by insisting on the condition. It would not bring him out of this exile. The rest of that day went in arranging with Lord Gotchern and others for the reception and lodging of the ship's company. At second hour, we set out by power sledge to Athten Fen, about 30 miles northeast of Erhenrang. The landing site was at the near edge of the great desolate region, a peat marsh too boggy to be farmed or settled, and now in mid-Irem, a flat, frozen waste many feet deep in snow. The radio beacon had been functioning all day, and they had received confirmation signals from the ship. On the screens coming in, the crew must have seen the Terminator lying clear across the great continent along the border, from Guthen Bay to the Gulf of Charizun, and the peaks of the Kargav still in sunlight, a chain of stars. For it was twilight when we, looking up, saw the one star descending. She came down in a roar and glory, and steam went roaring up white as her stabilizers went down in the great lake of water and mud created by the retro, down underneath the bog. There was permafrost like granite. And she came to rest balanced neatly, and sat cooling over the quickly refreezing lake, a great, delicate fish balanced on its tail, dark silver in the twilight of winter. Beside me, Fax of Otherhord spoke for the first time since the sound and splendor of the ship's descent.
"I'm glad I have lived to see this," he said.
So Estraven had said, when he looked at the ice, at death. So he should have said this night. To get away from the bitter regret that beset me, I started to walk forward over the snow towards the ship. She was frosted already by the interhull coolants, and as I approached, the high port slid open, and the exit way was extruded, a graceful curve down onto the ice. The first off was Lang Yu Hu, unchanged, of course, precisely as I had last seen her, 3 years ago in my life, and a couple of weeks in hers. She looked at me, and Fax, and at the others of the escort who had followed me, and stopped at the foot of the ramp. She said solemnly in Karhidish, "I have come in friendship." To her eyes, we were all aliens. I let Fax greet her first. He indicated me to her, and she came and took my right hand in the fashion of my people, looking into my face.
"Oh, Genli," she said, "I didn't know you."
It was strange to hear a woman's voice after so long. The others came out of the ship on my advice. Evidence of any mistrust at this point would humiliate the Karhidish escort, impugning their Shifgrethor. Out they came and met the Karhiders with a beautiful courtesy. But they all looked strange to me, men and women, well as I knew them. Their voices sounded strange, too deep, too shrill. They were like a troop of great, strange animals of two different species, great apes with intelligent eyes, all of them in rut in Kemer. They took my hand, touched me, held me. I managed to keep myself in control, and to tell Heo Hu and Tullia what they most urgently needed to know about the situation they had entered during the sledge ride back to Erhenrang. When we got to the palace, however, I had to get to my room at once. The physician from Sassinoth came in, his quiet voice and his face, a young, serious face, not a man's face and not a woman's, a human face. These were a relief to me, familiar, right. But he said, after ordering me to get to bed and dosing me with some mild tranquilizer,
"I've seen your fellow envoys. This is a marvelous thing, the coming of men from the stars, and in my lifetime."
There again was the delight, the courage, that is most admirable in the Karhidish spirit, and in a human spirit, and though I could not share it with him, to deny it would be a detestable act. I said without sincerity, but with absolute truth, "It is a marvelous thing indeed for them as well, the coming to a new world, a new mankind." At the end of that spring, late in Tua, when the thaw floods were going down and travel was possible again, I took a vacation from my little embassy in Erhenrang and went east. My people were spread out by now all over the planet. Since we had been authorized to use the air cars, Heo Hu and three others had taken one and flown over Sith and the archipelago, nations of the sea hemisphere, which I had entirely neglected. Others were in Orgorain and too reluctant in Perunta, where the thaws do not even begin until Tua and everything refreezes, they say, a week later. Tullia and Kesta were getting on very well in Erhenrang, and could handle what might come up. Nothing was urgent. After all, a ship setting out at once from the closest of Winter's new allies could not arrive before 17 years planetary time had passed. It is a marginal world, on the edge. Out beyond it, towards the South Orion Arm, no world has been found where men live, and it is a long way back from Winter to the prime worlds of the Ecumen, the hearth worlds of our race, 50 years to Hain Davenant, a man's lifetime to Earth. No hurry. I crossed the Karagav, this time on lower passes, on a road that winds along above the coast of the Southern Sea. I paid a visit to the first village I had stayed in, When the fishermen brought me in from Horden Island 3 years ago, the folk of that hearth received me, now as then, without the least surprise. I spent a week in the big port city, Thatha, at the mouth of the river Ench, and then, in early summer, started on foot into Kernland. I walked east and south into the deep, harsh country, full of crags and green hills and great rivers and lonely houses, till I came to Icefoot Lake. From the lake shore, looking up southward at the hills, I saw a light I knew. The blink, the white suffusion of the sky, the glare of the glacier lying high beyond. The ice was there. Estre was a very old place. Its hearth and outbuildings were all of grey stone cut from the steep mountainside to which it clung. It was bleak, full of the sound of wind. I knocked and the door was opened. I said, I asked the hospitality of the domain. I was a friend of Therem of Estre. The one who opened to me, a slight, grave-looking fellow of 19 or 20, accepted my words in silence, and silently admitted me to the hearth. He took me to the wash-house, the tiring rooms, the great kitchen, and when he had seen to it that the stranger was clean, clothed, and fed, he left me to myself in a bedroom that looked down out of the deep-slit windows over the grey lake and the grey Thore forests that lie between Estre and Stok. It was a bleak land, a bleak house. Fire roared in the deep hearth, giving, as always, more warmth for the eye and spirit than for the flesh, for the stone floor and walls, the wind outside blowing down off the mountains and the ice, drank up most of the heat of the flames. But I did not feel the cold as I used to, my first 2 years on winter. I had lived long in a cold land now. In an hour or so, the boy... He had a girl's quick delicacy in his looks and movement, but no girl could keep so grim a silence as he did. Came to tell me that the Lord of Estre would receive me if it pleased me to come. I followed him downstairs, through long corridors, where some kind of game of hide-and-seek was going on. Children shot by us, darted around us, little ones shrieking with excitement, adolescents slipping like shadows from door to door, hands over their mouths to keep their laughter still. One fat little thing, of 5 or 6, caromed into my legs, then plunged and grabbed my escort's hand for protection.
"Sorve!"
he squeaked, staring up wide-eyed at me all the time.
"Sorve, I'm going to hide in the brewery!"
Off he went like a round pebble from a sling. The young man, Sorve, not at all discomposed, led me on and brought me into the inner hearth of the Lord of Estre. "Esvan's hearth, rem ir Estreven," was an old man, past 70, crippled by an arthritic disease of the hips. He sat erect in a rolling chair by the fire. His face was broad and blunted and worn down by time, like a rock in a torrent, a calm face, terribly calm.
"You are the envoy, Genri Ai."
"I am." He looked at me, and I at him. Therem had been the son, child of the flesh of this old lord. Therem, the younger son, Arek the elder, that brother whose voice he had heard in mind bespeaking him, both dead now. I could not see anything of my friend in that worn, calm, hard old face that met my gaze. I found nothing there but certainty, the sure fact of Therem's death. I had come on a fool's errand to Estre, hoping for solace. There was no solace. And why should a pilgrimage to the place of my friend's childhood make any difference, fill any absence, soothe any remorse? Nothing could be changed now. My coming to Estre had, however, another purpose, and this I could accomplish. "I was with your son in the months before his death. I was with him when he died. I've brought you the journals he kept. And if there's anything I can tell you of those days..." No particular expression showed on the old man's face. That calmness was not to be altered. But the young one, with a sudden movement, came out of the shadows, into the light, between the window and the fire, a bleak, uneasy light. And he spoke harshly.
"In Erhenrang, they still call him Estreven the traitor."
The old lord looked at the boy,
and then at me.
"This is Sorve Harth," he said. "Heir of Estre, my son's son."
There is no ban on incest there. I knew it well enough. Only the strangeness of it, to me a Terran, and the strangeness of seeing the flash of my friend's spirit in this grim, fierce provincial boy, made me dumb for a while. When I spoke, my voice was unsteady. "The king will recant. Therem was no traitor. What does it matter what fools call him?" The old lord nodded slowly, smoothly.
"It matters," he said.
"You crossed the goblin ice together?"
Sorve demanded.
"You and he?"
"We did."
"I should like to hear that tale, my Lord Envoy,"
said old Esvanth, very calm. But the boy, Therem's son, said, stammering,
"Will you tell us how he died? Will you tell us about the other worlds, out among the stars, the other kinds of men, the other lives?"
That is the end of Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin and read by Anthony Ofebu.
This concludes this talking book, originally recorded by the Royal National Institute for the Blind, United Kingdom, and reproduced by the CNIB Library for the Blind for use by individuals unable to read print due to a visual, physical, or perceptual disability.